Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, December 22nd, 2015. This is our final podcast before the holidays, final podcast of the year. We'll resume our regularly scheduled podcast programming on January 4th. Dr. Elmo's playing us into the podcast today. This is the bluegrass instrumental version of Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. And we'll regale you with the original hit song that has sold 16 zillion units at the end of the podcast today as we send Dr. Elmo off into a well-deserved retirement from his Christmas music gig. And into the news and comment that you downloaded this podcast for, we start today with a blockbuster from Seymour Hersh, one of America's most distinguished investigative journalists, who is not published by American corporate media anymore because the things that he reports are too explosive. And so in his latest dispatch, which you can find at the London Review of Books via a link in the podcast show file for this particular podcast, Seymour Hersh offers a fascinating theory about what has gone wrong with the Obama administration, the military, and the Obama strategy, such as it is, in the war against Daesh in Syria. And just a little bit of background, about 2 weeks ago, a California Congresswoman, Jackie Speier, Democrat, who serves on the Intelligence Committee, went public with some inquiries to the Pentagon, asking if the intelligence units in the Pentagon had purposefully soft-pedaled the threat of the Islamic State, or Daesh. And against that backdrop, Seymour Hersh offers some fascinating theories. And I have to call them theories because Hersh's reporting is thinly sourced. It is based on what appears to be one single anonymous source in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I am still relying on the legacy of Seymour Hersh to find this valid and at least worthy of reporting. And I leave it to you to read his lengthy piece, it's over 6,000 words, and decide for yourself. But friends of the administration, before Hersh's article is even widely read in the United States, are already tagging it as a bizarre conspiracy theory. And as you know, we talked to Professor Lance DeHaven Smith, who wrote the book Conspiracy Theory in America. That tag is used to marginalize or denigrate things that are found inconvenient by the Pentagon, by the intelligence community, and or the White House, sometimes in combination. And so I dismiss that out of hand. Now, what Hersh is alleging, again, based on unnamed sources primarily, is that top leaders of the Pentagon deliberately subverted American policy toward Syria by sharing American intelligence with friendly nations who are also friendly with Russia and Syria, and without directly telling those they gave the intelligence to pass it along, they made it clear that they thought that was a good idea. Now, the bottom line, what appears to motivate this based on Hersh's reporting, is that there was this huge disagreement. As Team Obama went looking for moderate Syrians that could be armed with the weapons that were grabbed from Gaddafi in Libya, yes, they came from Benghazi, and that is now widely known. And as you know, I don't support the president's so-called strategy. I think it is harebrained. It is based on you know, a lot of fantastical thinking. And the idea that we can take down the Assad government in Syria while vanquishing the Islamic State and then leaving a power vacuum that would most likely be filled, as we've heard from people like Andrew Bacevich and Gareth Porter in recent weeks, that vacuum would be filled by some other Islamic militant group very similar to Daesh or the Islamic State. So these are really serious allegations. They suggest that the Pentagon engaged in what amounts to a silent coup of the Obama administration, at least focused on the policy toward Syria. and the generals decided they knew better than the White House that propping up Assad is the best interim strategy to defeat this Sunni militant group called the Islamic State that we are responsible for the development and nurturing of. Hirsch goes on to report that massive amounts of money continue to flow from Saudi Arabia and other Muslim nations, including Turkey, to support the Islamic State, including as much as $700 million in the past year alone. So I encourage you to read Hirsch's piece, and feel free to read the critical commentary as well. But the bottom line here is that it appears that the military, as part of what Professor Peter Dale Scott dubbed the deep state, believes that the administration, well, it'll come and go. But the guys with the stars and bars seem to think that they know what's best. And while I dispute, as you know, the position and strategy of the Obama administration, that in no way condones that the military would basically run its own foreign policy by going around the administration. And Hirsch ends his article this way: Obama now has a more compliant Pentagon. There will be no more indirect challenges from the military leadership to his policy of disdain for Assad and support for Erdogan of Turkey. Dempsey, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and his associates remain mystified by Obama's continued public defense of Erdogan, given the American intelligence community's strong case against him, and the evidence is that Obama in private accepts that case. The Joint Chiefs and the Defense Intelligence Agency were constantly telling Washington's leadership of the jihadist threat in Syria and of Turkey's support for it. The message was never listened to. Hirsch ends with the question, why not? Well, it has been an ugly year, made even uglier by the Donald. And just when you think that Trump has gone as low as possible, his invective in the debate last week suggesting that he would target the wives, the mothers, and the sisters of jihadists and track them down and kill them, that's the implication that he left. Well, he's done it again. And last night, as he was appearing in Michigan on the campaign trail, he criticized Hillary Rodham Clinton for losing to Barack Obama in 2008. Quote, said Trump, "She was favored to win, and she got schlonged." Wow. Now, this raises the question of just what kind of dick Donald Trump is. And I'm not asking what size his penis is. I'm saying that this guy is a really big dick. And he is such a misogynist that he thinks that it's okay to talk this way. As you know, I don't support Secretary Clinton for president. But this is so far below the belt and below any standard of American political discourse that you simply have to speak up. I thought of ignoring this. You know, I don't like to give any kind of attention to a boorish loudmouth like Donald Trump any more than necessary. But because he continues to shock us by descending further and further from any standards of decency, well, I think it can't go uncommented on. He also made light of Hillary's bathroom break during Saturday night's debate. I saw it, and she returned late after a commercial break. The Sanders and O'Malley were back at their podia, and she came back with a sheepish grin on her face, and it turns out that the women's room was much farther away from the stage than the men's room. And I don't know about you, but I tend to avoid speculating about, you know, what people do in the bathroom. I think it's their business. But Trump made light of it. He said, "I know where she went. It's disgusting, and I don't want to talk about it." So bodily functions are disgusting to Donald Trump? And he'll vilify his opponent for having to go to the bathroom? Oh, boy. That's what's disgusting. A new poll shows that half of American voters would be embarrassed if Donald Trump becomes president. Under 25% say they would be proud to have Trump as their commander-in-chief. It's interesting when you look at younger voters, 18 to 34, a full 73% say they'd be embarrassed by Trump. Only 13% say they would be proud. Now, one of the people who's so proud of Donald Trump that he bragged on Facebook and to friends that he would, Donald Trump's on again on TV, and I'm happy leaders, okay, but this guy's a great point man. I'll follow this man to the end of the world. That was posted on October 21st by 55-year-old William Chelly, who lives across the bridge from me in Richmond, California. Now, what's interesting is he made a series of threats against Muslims, outrageous racist comments on Facebook, and they were so alarming that a former neighborhood, a neighbor of his who grew up with him in Connecticut, took screenshots of his postings and gave them to her local police department, which then relayed them to the police in Richmond, California. But it took them 16 days to decide to arrest this guy. And what is astounding is that he went to a nearby mosque on the 4th of December. It's called Masjid al-Rahman. It's located in Richmond. And he went there and started shouting at people who were leaving a prayer service, "I'm going to kill you all." So his former neighbor in Connecticut sent these screenshots, and then the Richmond police called to confirm that she had sent them and that she wasn't some kind of a nut. And then she said she never heard from them again. Why did it take 16 days to bring into custody a guy who supports Donald Trump, who's making threatening remarks about Muslims? Well, I don't know the answer to that, but it is troubling. And also here in the Bay Area, we have a case of a so-called domestic terrorist, a young man named Adam Shafi. He grew up in Fremont, California. His parents, I believe, are Egyptian originally. And he went to San Francisco International Airport last July 3rd and was stopped by agents as he was boarding a flight to Turkey. Now, it appears that Adam Shafi had ideas of joining the Islamic State, and he made some comments that were intercepted in federal wiretaps, where he basically admitted to a friend that he had lied to the FBI agents who stopped him at San Francisco Airport. Now he has been charged with attempting to provide material support to a terrorist group. But he didn't do anything except buy a plane ticket. And it remains to be seen as this case is prosecuted, and I hope he doesn't take a guilty plea so we can actually hear the evidence against him and hear his version of the facts. But at what point does an idea of supporting an enemy become a criminal act? And I don't know the exact answer to that. I'm coming up with a lot of good questions and not so many answers today. But experts who were interviewed by Bob Agelko, the very talented legal affairs writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, talk about the law that was passed after September 11th, the Patriot Act and other amendments to it, that created this new crime called material support. And material support doesn't exist in other countries. It's not part of international law. And that's why we had to release some guys from Guantanamo who had been accused and convicted of material support, a crime that did not exist when they were taken into custody. Professor Robert Weisberg at Stanford calls the law unbelievably broad. Jonathan Schmidt, a former federal prosecutor who teaches law at the University of California, it has a potential to be overused. It also has a potential to disrupt terrorist acts before they occur. Well, we'll see how the courts handle this particular case. In London, a family of 11, mostly children, was blocked from a flight from Gatwick to Los Angeles. It's a Muslim family, and they were planning to go to Disneyland and Universal Studios and visit a family member who is an American citizen living in Southern California. But these people were approached by officials from America's Homeland Security in the departure lounge and told that their authorization to travel had been canceled without any explanation. And on top of that, the airline refused to refund the cost of their tickets, more than $10,000, even though they were blocked from the flight through no fault of their own. And it occurs to me that Donald Trump, who's been elected absolutely nothing, and who decreed that he would block Muslims from entering the country, is our Homeland Security Department taking its orders from Donald Trump? And this is not the only incident. An imam and lecturer based in Bristol named Ajmal Mansour tried to get on a flight to New York on the 17th of December and was told only that his travel authorization had been revoked. No explanation. And this underscores the point I've been making recently that when President Obama links the San Bernardino shootings to his call to make it illegal for someone on the no-fly list or a terrorist watch list to buy guns, that I cannot support it. Hell, I'm for all kinds of restrictions on gun purchases, but not based on this unconstitutional and arbitrary system which puts people on the no-fly list. Every day I like to stop for a minute and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and it's my last opportunity this year to ask you to become a subscriber yourself. So people like Jeff Lipinski, Deborah Kennedy, Mark Brodsky, the irrepressible Faith Peoples, and Nick Yaksich, whose name is on two pages here, thanks for your support all through the year 2015. And if you have not supported me in the past, let me invite you to come over to peterbcollins.com. The menu button on the upper right, you click that. Next, you choose Become a Subscriber. On that page, you can select $5, $10, $20 a month, our $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount by PayPal. You can mail in a check or money order to P.O. Box 100, Mill Valley, California, 94942. And I'll remind you that we now have an arrangement with the fine folks at Spreaker. Look for Spreaker, S-P-R-E-A-K-E-R, in the App Store of your Android system. They also have an app for the iPhone, but Spreaker is taking care of the fact that we were not providing a platform for our Android users to get the podcast easily. So we've solved that. And, of course, you can buy for just $3, $2.99, in the Apple App Store, the official Peter B. Collins app for the iPhone and iPad. And once again, I'm grateful to everyone who has supported my work, and I'm looking forward to an exciting year in 2016. Well, it's really sad. Back in July, the nation was riveted by the story of Sandra Bland, the Chicago woman who drove to Prairie View, Texas, where she was accosted by a Texas law enforcement officer. And the video shocked us all. Because Sandra Bland correctly objected to her treatment by the officer, she refused to get out of the car because she suspected that he was going to do bad things to her, and she was right. And we know about the traffic stop. We don't know how she died. She died in custody in the jail there in Texas 3 days later. She was found hanging from a trash bag in her cell. And a grand jury has declined to indict anyone for her death. We know that the trooper has been placed on administrative leave, but we don't know of any other discipline that has been applied to him. And this really amounts to a sad cover-up of a case where at least the family of Sandra Bland deserves to know how she died and who was responsible. And to his credit, Bernie Sanders, who was brushed back by Black Lives Matter protesters in Seattle this summer, he issued a statement following the grand jury decision. Quote, Sandra Bland should not have died while in police custody. There's no doubt in my mind that she, like too many African Americans who die in police custody, would be alive today if she were a white woman. My thoughts are with her family and loved ones tonight. We need a reform. We need to reform a very broken criminal justice system. Well, Bernie's right about that. There's been a lot of attention this year to the Black Lives Matter movement. And in recent weeks here in San Francisco, we had an incident where five police officers shot and killed a young man named Mario Woods. And they said he had a knife, but the video doesn't show him with a knife. And the fact that five officers pumped bullets into him while he was standing there surrounded by them has really raised a ruckus here. Demands have been made for the resignation of our police chief. And I want to play for you a comment that came from an activist from Oakland named Kat Brooks, who crossed the bridge to San Francisco to challenge the police commission over the death of Mario Woods. And I believe that what she says here can be applied in Chicago, in Baltimore, in New York, in Ferguson, and it certainly applies here in San Francisco.
Founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project and a member of the Black Power Network, and I'm actually based in Oakland, but here supporting San Francisco. After Mario was murdered, executed in broad daylight in your city, I asked myself, I posted on Facebook, as a matter of fact, how long is it going to take for the chief to come out and tell the community that we didn't see what we thought we saw on that video? How long is it going to take for the police to come out and tell us that we didn't understand the circumstances surrounding that murder? Because that's the tape. That's what happens every time. We see what happens, and then you trot yourself out and tell us that we are not intelligent enough to understand that we saw a black man gunned down execution style in broad daylight in the streets of San Francisco. And somehow you think that talking to us like we are children who have not been examining, watching, studying you and your system for hundreds of years as we figure out how to tear it down, push back, and eventually win. As you continue to talk to us like children, what you are doing is inciting the rage of the people. And I want to be clear with you all that a new day has come. To San Francisco, to Oakland, to Baltimore, to Ferguson, to Atlanta, there is a movement sweeping this country. And we are not going to stop until you stop killing us. Until you stop killing us, we will continue to shut it down, interrupt your business as usual. We're going to take to the streets. We're going to interrupt your election cycles. And I have news for you, Chief, sir. We are going to shut it down until you resign or until all of you get the courage to fire him.
You go, Kat Brooks. You go. I think she speaks for many African Americans about the anger that continues to build over law enforcement treatment of blacks in this country. And here's a case that begs for attention. The FBI set up an elaborate sting operation to entrap elected officials and others in San Francisco. And they spent more than $1 million wining and dining people at very expensive restaurants and hotels. And right now, they are trying Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. He is a former Asian gang leader in Chinatown who says he has reformed. And they tried to entrap him 9 different ways, maybe it was a dozen, in the operation of this sting. And the real ace that Shrimp Boy has is his lawyer, Tony Serra. The guy with bad teeth, thrift shop clothes, a ponytail, and a guy who has defeated the government in Chinatown cases before. And so they pulled a big surprise, and they called Shrimp Boy as the first witness for the defense. And he spent the full day yesterday on the stand, describing his criminal background, talking about how when he cut a deal to be released from a 28-year sentence, that he was promised they'd put him in the witness protection program and move him to a new location, but they didn't. And so Shrimp Boy is singing and singing loud these days. I did not kill Alan Jung. I did not order the killing of Alan Lung, he said, raising his voice. And he also denies any involvement in the death of Jim Tat Kong, who was killed by an unknown assailant in 2013. Now, it's interesting because the government didn't originally charge him with both murders. They amended the charges very late in the process. And so I personally have no knowledge of whether Shrimp Boy is guilty or innocent, but he has an excellent lawyer, and I think he will ultimately not be convicted. That is my hunch at this stage. As you know, I've raised a lot of questions about the official narrative of the shootings in San Bernardino, California. And as we head into this holiday period, I don't think the corporate media is going to do any more work to trace down the third shooter, to follow up on a lot of the inconsistencies that I pointed out in a recent podcast called 13 Questions. And it really saddens me that these official narratives get locked in, and that we see the law enforcement builds on half-truths, on unproven allegations and assertions, and it kind of snowballs from there. And Paris is fairly well locked down. It's almost a police state now, and they are still looking for the most wanted man in Europe, Salah Abdeslam, who is thought to be the ringleader of the Friday the 13th attacks in Paris. And now we learn from one of his accomplices who has been picked up, who essentially helped spirit him out of the Paris area to Belgium on the day after Friday the 13th, that their car was stopped three different times by French police. One of the cops noticed that some of the people in the car were smoking weed. And he said, well, that's not a good thing, but we're focused on other shit today. And so not once, not twice, but three times, the most wanted man in Europe was stopped by the police and they let him go. According to the news accounts, at least twice he was forced to supply identification. But apparently at that point they didn't know who they were looking for. And it's this kind of Keystone Cops activity that's covered up in secrecy, and the secrecy is supported by the media, and half-truths and assertions that can't be proven are inserted into the narrative. And then that becomes the consensus view. And nothing good is built on top of that. Got a couple of quickies here before I wrap up, because there is so much news as we head into the holidays. A federal judge in Miami has ordered Guantanamo tactics to be used on 10 men who are hunger striking. They're prisoners in our detention center for immigrants outside Miami, the Chrome Detention Center. And they have been refusing to take food for 3 weeks. And so a judge has authorized the medical staff to restrain and force feed these prisoners. And I'm really sorry to see that. Dennis Hastert, the tarnished former Republican Speaker of the House, who pled guilty to a single charge of structuring financial transactions in late October. Well, we have learned just in the last week or so that a week after he pled guilty, he entered the hospital after having a stroke. And in addition to the stroke, he picked up sepsis in the hospital and has had two back operations. And this is one of the most sordid stories of the year, where the corporate media only scratched the surface. They only brought you the story of Denny Hastert paying off the former student of his who he sexually assaulted or had an inappropriate relationship with 35, 40 years ago. We only know that person as Individual A, and he was not charged with any crime for accepting the over $1 million that was paid to him by Dennis Hastert. But Hastert got busted for that. And if you want the full story of Dennis Hastert, go to BoilingFrogsPost.com. Sibel Edmonds has unveiled it all for you there. It is extremely sordid, and it shows that a lot of people went to great lengths to cover up the obvious crimes of Speaker Hastert. No crimes were found in a careful review of the hours of videotapes that were secretly shot of Planned Parenthood officials and attempt, you know, they were selectively edited as part of this whole effort to take down Planned Parenthood this year. Federal District Judge William Orrick has watched all the videos, and he said that he saw no evidence of a crime being committed, and he still refuses to release the rest of the videos because of threats to the Planned Parenthood officials who appeared in them without their permission. So this is a pretty definitive analysis that these videos, despite what Carly Fiorina has made up, really showed no evidence of criminal behavior. But they carefully created this propaganda smokescreen that persuaded a lot of people this year. And fortunately, Nancy Pelosi was able to prevent the ugly riders that Republicans had threatened to attach to the budget bill, cutting off funding to Planned Parenthood. And finally today, this year was really tragic for the people of Greece, the island nation that was forced by the European bankers to accept another dose of austerity. And we have an island possession called Puerto Rico. And we're doing the same thing. Only there are American wealthy vulture capitalists who have bought up all of the debt, the bonds that were issued by the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. And they are extracting their profits and using their leverage to do two things: to force the Puerto Rican government to cut spending even further. They've already cut education, and they're going to have to cut more. And they're really shortchanging the future of the people of Puerto Rico in order to make a couple of rich people in New York even richer. It's obscene. And the other thing these wealthy vulture capitalists are doing is they've hired a whole army of lobbyists in order to persuade the Congress not to change the bankruptcy laws to allow relief for Puerto Rico. And in a story in the New York Times this past Sunday, they detailed how Senator Marco Rubio, who wants to be president, was approached by a Democrat, Blumenthal from Connecticut, to co-sponsor a bill to permit at least some bankruptcy relief for some of the government entities in Puerto Rico. And initially, Marco Rubio said, yeah, I'll sign on to that. And then he found out that one of his biggest donors is one of the investors, one of the vultures, who is profiting from the debt status of the island of Puerto Rico. And at that point, Marco Rubio stopped responding to calls about that bill. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. And as we head off into the holidays, I would be remiss if I didn't share this song with you one more time. My friend Elmo Shropshire has been singing it since about 1977. Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer has sold more than 16 million copies worldwide. And during the holidays, if you're at a bowling alley or a party or a bar, there's a good chance you're going to hear this song. And I will warn you, it's an earworm song that may be very difficult to get out of your head for days and days and days. At the age of 79, Elmo still runs marathons. He's in better shape than I am. But he has decided to retire from the Christmas music scene. And I want to wish him all the very best. He's made me smile year after year after year.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. She'd been drinking too much eggnog, and we begged her not to go. But she forgot her medication, and she staggered out the door into the snow. When we found her Christmas morning at the scene of the attack, she had hoof prints on her forehead and incriminating claws marks on her back. Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now we're all so proud of Grandpa. He's been taking this so well. See him in there watching football, drinking beer and playing cards with Cousin Mel. It's not Christmas without Grandma. All the family's dressed in black. And we just can't help but wonder, should we open up her gifts or send them back?
Send them back!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now the goose is on the table, and the pudding made of fig.
Ah!
And the blue and silver candles that would just have matched the hair in Grandma's wig. I've warned all my friends and neighbors, better watch out for yourselves. They should never give a license to a man who drives a sleigh and plays with elves. Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Sing it, Grandpa!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.